Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Meine Damen und Herren, Mesdames et Messieurs, Ladies und Gentlemen. Welcome to Censored, or willkommen nach Censored. I am your host, und sagen that I am Lloyd Mae Houston.
And I'm Aoife Fortnach, and I love the introduction. Absolutely multilingual brilliance.
This is only going to get more insufferable from here, as I am assuming that a not insignificant proportion of you have inferred from that opening. Our subject this time is a text, I think, kind of close to both of our hearts, which is 1972's Cabaret, which I've been told I can't sing for copyright reasons. So it'll just be liberal quoting. But yes, leave your troubles outside. In here, life is beautiful. Even the hosts are beautiful. which is why we operate in a purely audio.
Yeah, movie, we're obviously not recording this because...
Faces for radio. Yeah.
This was a film that we both agreed from the very beginning. Like, the minute we sat down to sketch out what films we would look at, we were like, let's do Cabaret. Great. Yeah, look, they want to do it too.
Let's check it was censored, but if it was, yeah. Let's, you know.
Yeah, there was.
Almost even if it wasn't.
There was a moment where we were like, but was it? Was it like even banned or anything? We have to check. We have to put this in. And luckily for us, it was ish.
I was going to say, through the good archival auspices of Aoife, we in fact have a pretty clear picture of what was trimmed when. So look forward to that.
Because it was shown in Ireland in 1972, which is the year it's released in the US and everywhere else. But it's an 18s plus, which is the certification that's like, I mean, in Ireland, it's the highest. There isn't an X in Ireland. There's no like porno cert. There's 18s only. So it is restricted viewing, very much so.
Which, again, just seems so A, disproportionate, and B, I don't know, censoring something that is about the curtailing of the freedom of expression. It's always a good way to make yourself look bad.
But I mean, certification is an improvement on what was gone before.
This is true. Yes. It's, to be honest, I was surprised that this screened kind of at all, and that the cuts seemed as thoughtful as they did. But I guess we can get into that.
So shall we first then say, why do we love Cabaret? In like 5 minutes or less, if we can manage that.
That's said like someone who just had to edit the Northern Ireland episode.
Not complaining.
Well, for my part, Cabaret is, I have, you know, adored it since my teens. It was a very dear friend of mine to whom I owe a great deal in terms of my sort of cultural education, who I did youth theater with, who showed it to me. And let's say that, you know, a great deal that would kind of click later was clearly making me vibe with this narrative of the diversely gendered and sexually diverse and permissive landscape of Weimar Berlin and its cabaret scene viewed through the eyes of, you know, our sort of ingenue, you know, kind of slightly slightly naive Brian in the film version. We're going to get into almost immediately a lot of confusion over how to refer to this dude, because in different versions of this text, he is different people. But yeah, just everything about the vibe of the club, like, but also the revisiting it this time, particularly the way in which it really evokes and deliberately leverages the visual style of German Expressionism, but also the paintings of and drawings of Egon Schiele, and more things that this film vibes with are things that in life I've gone on to vibe with. Also, the tunes are just, you know, it's Candler and Ebb. You cannot argue with, like, everything's a banger. And the problem is that some of them are things that you don't want to go out into the street singing. You know, like, you don't want to emerge from it kind of humming Tomorrow Belongs to Me. but it's an undeniably effective number.
I mean, yeah, for me, the music was, like, just got me straight away. The song Money Money, I could never get tired of that. I could literally sing that any day of the week, do the actions, the whole thing. But also Liza Minnelli's hairstyle as Sally Bowles, just loved it. Always been a fan of extremely short hair on women. And
yeah, I was going to say no part of this rubbed off.
None of it whatsoever.
We were, neither of us were affected in any way by exposure to this film.
No. And also I've, like, always had a really strong interest in the aesthetic of the 20s and the 30s. And I just think it's fascinating how the Sally Bowles character on screen has become so much part of what we think the 20s and 30s looked like. Like, it's such a visually influential depiction that publications of Goodbye to Berlin, the novel that inspired the screen and the play versions, have effectively someone who looks pretty much like Liza Minnelli on the front cover, you know? Because it just refers back to the original in a way that's unavoidable. And I love that. I love the way that all these versions are moving around in space, talking to each other and constantly being adapted and changed. Yeah, that's what I love about it. And the tunes and the gritty 100%. Club and the legs. It's all great.
Yeah, it's also, I mean, you know, it's just sexy.
It's hot, right? Really.
It's hot. It's hot stuff. It's catchy. But also, you know, it's one of the great pieces of anti-fascist art of the late 20th century. You know, come for the chorus line, stay for the pretty probing examination of how fascism institutes itself and manufactures consent. And that's another element of it that is, you know, that remains chilling. Like, it'd been a while since I'd seen the film version, but I had the good fortune to go along to the London stage production that's currently on, and having just watched that before I was going back to the film, I was like, oh, you know, is this gonna feel a bit sort of lukewarm and like pulling its punches when I return to it? And no, it really doesn't. It, you know, quite literally, there are several sequences where people are like viciously beaten and, like, you know, interspliced with like the whole kind of thigh slapping kind of like the way it uses the club to do social commentary is like, it ruined me for other musicals.
And how it uses the uncommented on visuals as the characters are walking around. There's various flags, there's posters, there's all the paraphernalia.
Radio broadcasts as well, the kind of, like, the way it leverages the German language to communicate certain things.
Yes. I thought that was really, like, for me, the watching of it this time, I was thinking about, which is something I've been thinking about lately, is how material from American movies and American Broadway stuff is written by a lot of, you know, Jewish emigres or their descendants, a lot of whom are deeply familiar with German as a language, you know, like, have had personal experience of it. And how that must have felt to make a piece of art with a language that you knew, but a language that represented the genocide. I mean, just all of that, I was like, wow, this is a whole other level now, because it's something now that people would discuss very explicitly as problematic about a piece of work that, you know, that they had reproduced the language of, you know, the genocidal maniacs. So I just, like, that was just for me another piece where I was like, oh, this now has something new to say to me about how we talk about controversial stuff that happened to us and how do we reproduce analysis of it by using the original material.
And yeah, if we extend censorship to just think about questions of, you know, the harm that can attend depicting certain things, or like, you know, can you ever depict Nazi iconography in a way that doesn't facilitate counter-identificatory readings that actually make it celebratory rather than condemnatory or whatever. Again, something I was going back to this with slight trepidation about was how it handled that. And like, it's so strategic about when you see a swastika and how the explicitly Nazi characters in it are depicted. And it's, yeah, it just, it's so deft and it knows exactly when to hit you and how. You know, there's a danger when media depicts Nazism to that in order to represent the threat of fascism, it will unthinkingly replicate some of fascism's self-positioning as like extremely efficient and omnicompetent and, you know, hyper-masculine and self-possessed and infallible. And this really kind of nails more of a sense of like, no, these are a bunch of like opportunistic upstart thugs who just kick the shit out of people. Yeah. And, you know, are boorish and craven.
Shall we talk about that hilarious page from the censor's notebook? just to explain, so in the National Archives, there are the records of the film censor, and they comprise the kind of top-level certification-style records, which are very formal. But behind that, they created, as they sat watching the film, they had a notebook issued by the civil service, I'll have you know. That was the front cover, issued by the civil service. A notebook and a pen. And they're just, you know, roughly noting what they are looking at, what might be objectionable. So it's the kind of the process of the censorship is this particular notebook. And there was a very detailed page on Cabaret, which I gleefully sent to Lloyd and was like, we're sorted.
Yeah, I was astonished and delighted when this came through.
What really struck me about it is how he, from the mechanics of the film censorship process, is how he's breaking it up into the reels, which as a viewer, you don't see at all. You just see a continuous film, but he's like watching it in segments, which I find fascinating. Like, so the censor doesn't see the film beginning to end straight, but reel one, reel two, as they go through.
It's like he's watching it on streaming, you know. It's
he's pausing it.
Second screen content.
He's probably going out for, you know, grab something to eat after two reels because he's a bit hungry. Yeah, it's such a different viewing experience. But the what made me laugh about it, of course, was the red pen. There are red X's.
Well, what do you think? Like, is it, does the number of them correspond to the intensity of the objection, or is it each instance of the thing occurring? Because, you know, for example, there's Sally Baby, I think, is the one kind of listed at what I'm assuming is like the 118th foot, maybe, or something. I don't know. And it's like three X's. And do we think that's like, no. Or is that like, no that time.
Or... Yeah, I'm inclined to think it could be where the cuts are being made. So it corresponds to, I want you to cut this and no, definitely not.
Yeah, that was kind of my assumption was, yeah, where the instance of the thing occurred. Because there's, so, for example, syphilis, as anyone who knows anything about what I work on, you know, I'm delighted to see it getting a look in. But yeah, so syphilis crops up twice in sort of dialogue, once during this kind of fantastically awkward English language class, like conversation class, where it's Brian, Sally, and this wealthy Jewish department store owner's daughter, and this gigolo character on the make. And they're having this incredibly strained conversation. And then Sally, you know, drops in that she's just saw this, this, you know, fantastic picture about syphilis. And, you know, asking, like, is it true that you can get it through, you know, through kissing? And the surveyor's like, yes, you can. And, you know, through sharing a teacup, just as, like,
yeah,
a teacup is being passed to her. it's really brilliant stuff. I'm there's also part of me that's like, oh, okay, was that damaged goods, do you think? Like I the film's actually quite good at pointing to stuff in, you know, the contemporary culture. There's a point where Clara Bow gets a shout out, if you remember, when they're out.
Yes,
on the boat.
I know, I saw that and I was like, woohoo, yes, Clara Bow.
There she is. Yeah.
On a boat.
but yeah, so that first instance of syphilis seems to have been cut. But then there's a second point where Sally is like saying how she batted off someone who was like chatting her up in the club. She's like, oh, I told him I had the slightest touch of syphilis. and that's allowed to stay. So
it's really funny to see the notes. So I presume as he's going through, he's like, syphilis, well, that might be a problem. And then he's like, no, it's probably okay. So it gets a tick next to it if he's okay. And I mean, looking at the other records in this particular book, he has this tick cross thing going on elsewhere. Mm. Yeah, and I think, no, he doesn't always use red for the crosses. But yeah, I think it means cut. That would be my...
Yeah, I would assume so. So what we also get, so fornication gets cut from that scene.
Yes.
You remember they're trying to, at the end of this conversation, sorry, this is, I promise it won't just become like doing the movie, but at the end of that conversation about syphilis, Sally then says, and, you know, they list all these like, you know, peripheral ways you can contract syphilis. And then Sally's like, and of course from screwing. And then, you know, because her colloquial English isn't good enough, this character is like screwing. And then, you know, everyone tries to kind of gloss the word for her. And so fornication is one of the glosses that's given, but... Can't be mentioning fornication.
I mean, it's a peculiarly old-fashioned word by 1972.
Yeah, I feel like one of the things that you kind of get a sense of through the layering up of ticks and crosses is that it's like if too much time is spent with the topic, he seems to get kind of uncomfortable, you know. So it's like, yeah, you can briskly, you know, blink and you'll miss it, kind of have a brush with that. Or you get like one joke about sex, but you can't like... Kind of. Have two, you know.
He did say in an interview with a journalist that year, this month actually, April 1972, that he looked at films as if, once again, this sounds very familiar for previous censors, that, you know, it would be suitable for his children aged 10 to 19. And I'm like, but like, there's a big difference between a 10-year-old and a 19-year-old.
Yeah. It's like, you don't parent the two ends of that pole the same way. Like,
yeah, one is in university and one is in primary school. What is going on? Even though he gives this an 18, so like a 10-year-old is not supposed to be watching this.
Yeah, and I don't know what 18-year-old is going to be, you know, given head staggers by explicit reference to fornication.
They'd probably be like, what word is that again? I'd have to go look it up. But
what's the thing at 63? I can't Sally and Brian
in bed.
Okay, yeah.
Sally and Brian,
when they get
bed.
One of them in bed.
Yeah, so they do end up in bed a few times, like they are shown in the physical bed, either naked, semi-naked, or about to get naked. So yeah, that got a red cross, so I suspect at least some of that was caught. But the part that really jumped out for me with the three crosses and the two crosses, it's all about the storyline involving Sally, pregnancy, and then an abortion.
Yeah, it's, yeah.
It's not surprising, is it?
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Well, it's not surprising, but it kind of is, given that in and around that storyline, we have a very, not explicit in the sense of like we watch people at it or anything, a not remotely sort of discreet storyline about an emerging, like slightly uncomfortable love triangle thruple that is heavily insinuated to, you know, kind of be on the cusp of culminating in a three-way. And it being made equally clear that Brian has had sex with Max, this, you know, kind of very charming moosh businessman type. And so, you know, given that, that, you know, quote unquote, homosexuality was as criminalized as abortion at this point, I find it really interesting that it's, you know, it's hard to know whether that speaks to a kind of tacit tolerance on the part of the censor regarding it, or a kind of assumption that, like, as long as it stays moderately euphemistic, it's fine, or whether it's, you know, it is just a kind of straightforward, like, this is the more urgent issue about which I'm more morally concerned. But yeah, I find it really interesting that, like, you can't mention that Sally is pregnant, which, like, really must hobble the film. Like, it, like, the last act must make no sense.
Yeah, and if you...
if they aren't talking about that baby.
If you take out the abortion, like, how they part and why makes no sense.
Well, I had a question about this in my own head, which was whenever, you know, because the way it's written up on this sheet, it's just, you know, abortion, there's a time code, and then it's just abortion and two crosses. Mm. And deleted, I think, is written also kind of alongside that. Now, in my head, I'm wondering, because the word abortion is explicitly used in the script. So he sort of, you know, he says, like, did you did it? Or, you know, he says something that kind of alludes to it, and then he explicitly uses the word abortion. And, you know, so I'm wondering, does this mean cut the word abortion, but keep the kind of allusion to it? Or do we think the whole thing is gone?
Yeah, it's not clear from that. And also some of the contemporary media coverage they are talking about in the Sunday Independent. There's a journalist called Kieran Carty who is running a kind of one-man campaign to draw attention to censorship throughout this period. So he's kind of every week writing about it. And he mentions that Cabaret is passed with cuts, but he doesn't talk about how extensive those cuts are, or the length of the film that was lost, which he does. That's how he talks about the censorship to the readers, which is like the way it worked. So he says, you know, like 8 minutes of cuts or 2 minutes of cuts or whatever. So he's trying to inform people how...
here's how much movie you've been denied.
Exactly. Yeah, which is like, it's the perfect way. It's like 8 minutes? That's quite long, you know?
Yeah.
So it's a really good way of trying to raise the issue. But he doesn't say exactly how much of this was cut. I kind of suspect it can't have been too bad because he would have made a fuss about it otherwise. So maybe it was more that they cut the word and some of the discussion around it, but, you know, that the baby is still no longer there, must have been left. Otherwise, the ending would have collapsed. Yeah, so it seems to be mostly syphilis, fornication, a bed scene, and cuts around the abortion.
And Sally's, like, pregnancy.
And Sally's pregnancy, yeah, presumably.
Which is also something that, I mean, just by the by, listeners, that's also something that, like, the Irish Film Centre is often weirdly circumspect about. Just, like, just people being pregnant. On screen is like, it's more of an earlier concern, but like just acknowledging that, you know, like discussing pregnancy at all.
Mm, and,
you know,
childbirth as well, isn't it? Gone with the Wind, the childbirth scene. It's just, yeah, this is, I suppose, a later version of this weirdness around reproduction.
If you saw Cabaret in Ireland in 1972 and want to write in and let us know, that would be amazing.
I mean, the problem is that in the two documents that are left in the archive, it doesn't give the length cut. So we can't estimate how much proportionately of the film was actually cut. Although it's a great document and very revelatory, at the same time, you're still left with questions about the actual cinema experience after the cuts have been implemented.
It's a very interesting, again, example of how, you know, censorship exists at the intersection of various other legal and non-legal regimes around what is being regulated in Ireland at this time, which, on both sides of the border, includes abortion and queerness, you know, both as criminalized acts. So it's partly why I am surprised at, like, there not being more explicit cuts at, you know, the gender nonconformity and the kind of same-sex intimacy in the film, or at least allusions to same-sex intimacy in the film. Because, you know, 1972, we're not even at the point... I mean, we've had partial decriminalization in 1967 of consensual male same-sex sex over the age of 21 in the UK, but that's not been extended to the north of Ireland, for instance. You've not even yet had the kind of Save Ulster from Sodomy campaign really kick off.
Of course.
Look, I mean, you know, the DUP, they know how to do a slogan. I'll give them that. But, you know, and Geoffrey Dudgeon's sort of, you know, activism and the NIGRA, their work around this. It's not till 1982 that there's legislation in the north. Mm. It's not till 1993 that decriminalization occurs in the
south.
Republic.
Yeah.
So it's...
Yeah, so it is strange, isn't it? And also in the context of what's been banned at that time, right, film-wise, the censor banned Loot, which is a screen version of Joe Orton's play, and which is, deeply queer, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, obviously some versions of gay life on screen are unacceptable still within the censor's ambit at this point. So, like, it is interesting to know exactly how people saw it. And I think... Yeah. Like, Ciarán Carty's writing in the Sunday Independent every week, and he's trying at this time to, like, really draw attention to, you know, the process, actually. So he has this great thing every week. He lists movies going before the appeals board. So something that got rejected and is being appealed. So he lists that. And then he lists movies shown in Dublin, the title of the movie, its certification, its age rating, so 16s, 12s, whatever. And then he says whether it was cut or not. And there's a really great, great one where it's called the Anderson Tapes. I don't know what it is. Never saw it. Ooh. And he lists it as over 18, appeal, which means it was rejected and then passed on appeal. And words, Jesus Christ, cut. So he's like, so he puts that into the newspaper. So if you went to see the Anderson Tapes, you'd be like, well, it's missing the swears. And yeah, I mean, it's a really important campaign, I think, because he does the best part, though, which you'll love. He goes to famous directors and he tells them about the Irish censorship regime. Because, of course, they didn't know. Who's going to know the details?
I mean, no shade to Ireland, but it's not exactly a key market for anyone. Really.
Exactly. I mean, why would Federico Fellini know anything about how Irish censorship works? So Ciarán Carty goes and interviews him, tells him exactly how it works, and then prints his outraged responses. So I just, like, it's this series throughout April of him interviewing these famous... directors and producing under their, you know, Federico Fellini says this. Just brilliant. And it actually culminates with the new censor is Dermot Breen. He's appointed in 72. And Ciarán Carty actually goes to interview him in the censor's office. And he writes a great piece. Ooh. All about, like...
How fun. So would he have taken over after Cabaret?
No,
was
I think...
passed, or is this one of
his? I think he's certifying in Cabaret, yeah.
Okay, and what do we glean about Breen?
Well, he is actually the first censor with experience in film. He used to manage a movie theatre.
Okay.
And he...
That's a start.
Yeah. And he started the Cork Film Festival.
Okay.
Yeah. So he's quite...
There we go.
He's quite into
it. Okay, well, it makes slightly more sense, maybe, how he approaches the kind of cutting of this then.
Yeah. And I think, actually, that up to April, that's the only one that's cut, you know, in a serious way, like that's in the new releases. So he is very much more open, and he talks to Kieran Carty about his work, and it's an attempt, I think, by the censor's office to seem less, like, dictatorial and remote.
It's funny what happens when you let people actually, like, care about a medium, you know, oversee it, right? People who have been explicitly chosen because they're, like, ambivalent at best about it.
Yeah, I think it does. It must mark an important change within the government that they are willing to appoint somebody like that, because this is the sort of... It's a very small, kind of minor appointment in many ways, so it's within the gift of the government. This isn't, you know, it isn't open to massive competition. So it clearly, when they appoint someone like Breen, they are trying to make a statement about the future of censorship and that it will be different. And the fact that he lets people into the office and talks to them, I mean, he must have spoken to ministers about that before he did it. You know,
yes.
So like, because it's such a big departure. So it's clearly that although there are cuts being made, things aren't quite like they used to be, I suppose. Or at least there is an opportunity to have a dialogue about cutting as opposed to it just no one knows what's cut and why. It's pretty cool.
What's the name of the book that collects your man's writings? Because it's got quite a fun title, doesn't
Kieran it? Oh, yes. Kieran Carty's sort of memoir essay collection is Confessions of a Sewer Rat.
There we go. Yes. So that's one for your stockings. Look, was this partly just an exercise in us having an excuse to rave about how good Cabaret is, perhaps?
Yes.
But also, I mean, it does, you know, it's especially watching the film sort of back to back with going to see it on stage, like it's fascinating the life that text has lived and the kind of contexts it's spoken to, you know, to be this kind of set of sort of loosely connected novellas and stories in the 30s that I'm assuming run afoul of print censorship, right? I'm remembering
that,
right?
Absolutely. Yeah, I did an episode on Goodbye to Berlin with Jonathan Kemp. Yeah, it's absolutely banned. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, to that suppression into, you know, a kind of stage version. So it's a play called I Am Camera in the sort of 50s, and then it's the stage musical in the sort of 60s, which sanitizes certain elements of the sort of source material. Sally is English in the stage version, which is what the figure who Sally was based on, you know, was. She was this English, slightly down at heel, aristocratic figure with aspirations to be on the stage or whatever. But, you know, Cliff becomes this sort of straight American, kind of quite square-jawed type who is slowly politically awakened through the course of the thing and becomes frustrated with Sally's glibness. So then the film version kind of wants to, like, fix that sort of straightening out of stuff. Like, it sort of re-queers it by you know, making Cliff Ryan and making him much closer to sort of Isherwood's own sort of sexuality and stuff. And now you've got, you know, this kind of current London stage version, which is, you know, put it this way, if you kind of consult the program, you know, everyone's pronouns are listed, and there's not a lot of he him in that program. You know, it's a really exuberantly queer rendering of it, not just in the sense of who's cast in it or who's depicted, but like it's a queering of the show in really fabulous and chilling ways. I was brought to see it by someone who's, you know, near dear and queer to me, and yeah, by the end, just like ugly crying. there's no better musical about genocide, and that is a very weird thing to be able to say about.
What a strapline! I mean,
yeah, there are things that this production did with re-costuming a cast that has been very legibly gender diverse into these increasingly conformist outfits, these sort of loose-fitting, ugly brown suits that also evoke tacitly images of like piles of clothing in the camps. And so it's just in terms of communicating the ways in which genocides encompass not simply the extermination of lives, but extermination of ways of living and the way that all of those things are interconnected and kind of processes that mount, accelerate and intensify. And as I say, going back to the film, I was surprised how much of that is kind of latently present, right? And all the kind of interstitial, like interscene stuff and, you know, these sort of really haunting, like the way that Fosse uses stillness in that film is crazy. Like the sort of tableau of like violence, you know, there's a sort of murdered communist that they pass on their way off to, you know, kind of have a little jaunt around in the countryside with this wealthy magnate guy who wants to take them off to Africa, which also feels like it's a commentary on kind of, you know, like Eritrea and Italian fascist expansion in Africa, North Africa. It's really good. Like if somehow you have not watched Cabaret, watch Cabaret now.
Now, straight away.
It's all so good.
It's so good. I mean, everyone should watch it. It should be like on the curriculum or something. It's like one of those films that...
Well, it's just, if they're going to make, you know, I don't know, I actually don't know how the Republic compares on this, but, you know, like in the North and in the UK more broadly, like, you know, one, you study the rise of the Nazis so many times.
Oh, endlessly.
Like in history. Oh. Just over and over again. And, you know, hell, that is a lesson that bears being repeated. You know, like we can't be too frequently told not to sleepwalk into fascism. You know, but yeah, just like, just watch this film. It'll do it in, you know, like 2 hours.
Yeah. And I think having listened to my daughter talk about how, like, they have to learn about the war, obviously. Mm. And it's quite clear from the way it's being taught in schools now is that there is a tendency among some people who, you know, like war as a topic, who aren't attracted to the topic and all of that, that's why they're kind of interested in it. And I just think that a film like this would offer really good corrective if you were inclined to find war really exciting. And, you know, learning about the history of war is sexy, yes, but like this side of it, like what the violence does rather than just going off in fronts and tanks and all of that, I'm sorry to say, stereotypically boy kind of history. You know, it would... Yeah. Allow a different way of thinking about war. I think that might be quite congenial for people who weren't into the tanks.
Would it? Yeah, and just, you know, that it has a cultural dimension, that, you know, it, like that how you manufacture consent for conflict is done culturally, that how you know, select communities and ethnic groups and peoples and cultures for extermination plays out in the realm of culture, you know, and plays out in the realms of, you know, arbitrating permissible and impermissible discourses. And yeah, you know, none of this isn't connected to censorship and to senses of the sayable and the unsayable and how that produces, you know, the grievable and the ungrievable and the killable and the, you know, sorry, listeners, this is again gone from kind of frothy cabaret chat to, you know, things that may have, you know, well, you don't need us to tell you the contemporary resonances of elements of this. So, yeah, you know, just like keep your eyes and ears open and say things and, you know,
pay attention.
Do something. Sorry, listeners, again, we don't mean to slowly radicalize you.
Yeah. We don't mean to end up in this place at the end of most episodes, but it just happens that way, okay? Yeah. It's our brand.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.